You are listening to the cycling podcast at the Vuelta a España in association with Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I am once again with Daniel Freeb.
Hello, Richard.
And maybe no eating tonight, Daniel. We podcasted over dinner
the other night. Oh, yes, yes.
Somebody complained about the chewing
noises.
Rightly
so, it was a disgrace.
That was you. I mean, not you that complained, it was you. I think you were responsible for the chewing noises.
I'm sure it wasn't Lionel.
Apologise for
Lionel.
He wasn't there, you may remember, you may recall. Lionel's not here, Daniel. Lionel arrives on Friday. I leave on Friday. And I'm very sad to be leaving, actually, although I'm going on holiday.
Where are you going?
Going to Italy.
Oh, yeah, you're going to a wedding, aren't you?
Got a wedding on Sunday, which means that half of my bag is taken up by my kilt outfit. Should I wear my kilt tomorrow, last day on the Vuelta?
Why do you always wear a kilt at weddings? It's drawing attention to yourself. Anyway.
Not really. Anyway, yes, another cracker of a stage. Shall we head straight over to... we can discuss whether it was a cracker or not in a moment, Daniel, screwing up your face there. But let's head over to Watford and Lionel Burney for his tale of the etapa. Over to you, Lionel.
It was stage 11 of the Vuelta, and 5 years after his breakthrough victory at Peña Cabarga, Chris Froome won on the same mountain to increase the pressure on Nairo Quintana overall. A big group of 23 got away, but Alberto Contador's Tinkoff team kept the time gap sensible and limited the break's chances of fighting for the stage win. Ben Hermans and Jan Bakelants were the last survivors of the break to be reeled in on the final 6 kilometre climb, and they were captured in quick succession around 3 kilometres from the finish. Esteban Chavez of Orica Bike Exchange launched a strong attack with 1.8 kilometres left, but Leopold Koenig, Froome's teammate, did sterling work to bring the Colombian to heel. Then it was Quintana's turn to attack, accelerating with 700 metres to go. Froome responded, and suddenly first and third overall were away and heading for the line together, where the Skyman was the strongest. That meant Froome leapfrogged over Alejandro Valverde into second place overall, and now trails Quintana by 54 seconds. Valverde was third on the stage, with Koenig, Contador just behind them, and then the gaps opened up with Simon Yates, Michele Scarponi and Chavez the next over the line. So Quintana is in red, and he's also the King of the Mountains leader, although Omar Fraile will continue to wear that jersey, and the combined classification leader, and Froome will wear white again tomorrow. Valverde leads on points, so that means Movistar currently hold all 4 jerseys. But it's the overall lead that will concern them most. Movistar already saying Quintana might need 2.5 or 3 minutes over Froome going into next Friday's time trial. Tomorrow's stage to Bilbao has a second category climb inside the last 15 kilometres, but then a descent to the finish. Friday's stage is lumpy, but no uphill finish, and so the GC battle may go on to the back burner until Saturday's excursion into France and the finish on the Col d'Aubisque. The Vuelta is beautifully poised. Back to you guys in Spain.
Thank you for that, Lionel. Why were you screwing up your face earlier, Daniel?
Was it a cracker?
I know, I just said that because it was, you know... I suppose, like so many of these stages, it was a thrilling finale.
Perfect made-for-TV finale. It's a good length of climb, isn't it, for a summit finish, about a 6 or 7 kilometre climb, very steep. But there wasn't an awful lot of action until the last couple of kilometres. To be fair, we didn't really expect that much action because it was such a short climb. And also, having been up the climb today, it is very steep, and you might look at the roadbook and think, oh, you're 13%. Slopes or 15% slopes, so there's going to be a lot of damage here, but it goes up a little bit like the Lagos de Covadonga. It goes up in steps, and you often find 100, 200 metres of false flat or even descending road after a very steep section. So it was always likely that people were going to be able to recover. Indeed, they left it very late, didn't they, to start launching attacks.
They did. Fifth time, I think, Vuelta to Peña Cabarga. No one who's won there has ever gone on to win the Vuelta. There's a stat for you.
Shocking.
Before we actually really go into to today's stage and the ramifications of what happened to today's stage, we are, of course, the day after a rest day. Always tough, isn't it, the day after a rest day? For us as well as the riders. It was quite a tough day, I think. But yesterday, Daniel, on the rest day, obviously there were various press conferences and things. I went to Alberto Contador's, which was absolutely packed. Far fewer people at Chris Froome's. But I went and spoke to Chris Froome there and... spoke to him mainly about the climb the other day, where, of course, he dropped off the back of the group at the bottom and really rode up at his own pace, a tactic, a strategy that that seems to have inspired Nairo Quintana's call for a ban on power meters. We'll get on to that later on. But Froome certainly rode it at his own pace and almost caught Quintana, not quite, up the Lagos de Covadonga, of course. Anyway, here was Froome explaining a little bit that tactic, that strategy that he's got on the rest day. Here is Chris Froome. Well, Chris, so we saw how you rode yesterday and how you've been riding the climbs. What's it like, you know, at the moment when the race is sort of going away from you? Is the big challenge, the sort of mental one, to resist the urge to follow it at that time?
Yeah, I mean, there were a few factors. Obviously, a few things going through my mind yesterday. Obviously, there was fresh in my mind 2 days earlier when I got a bit carried away, gone for it on the earlier slopes and paid the price for it in the last K. And then also looking back at 2012, 2014, when I'd done Lagos de Covadonga before and suffered quite a bit towards the top. So I thought this time round, knowing that it's a long climb and knowing where I'm at with my form in terms of I'm not at my tour shape, I'm trying to build into this race, trying to get the best out of myself. It certainly didn't suit me to start that climb hard. And Movistar did ride hard at the bottom. They went very hard. And at that point, I made the call to ride a more steady steady pace further back and to ask my teammates to stick around me and take me as far as they could and before I pushed on myself.
How are you measuring your effort in those moments? Are you going on what your power meter is telling you, on feel? How are you gauging it?
More on feel. I mean, yeah, of course the power meter's there and I'm aware of the numbers I'm doing, but at the end of the day, it is more on feeling, definitely more on feeling, and something that I've got to sort of feel where if I'm going too hard or not, and being able to judge that. Obviously, the closer to the top of the climb that I got, I could go deeper, knowing that so it was almost like a progressive effort.
So if we were to look at your power meter at the end, would we see quite a consistent effort, or are those spikes coming more towards the end?
I think so. I think it was quite a consistent, just looking at the file, quite a consistent effort that got progressively faster, obviously, as I got closer to the top and trying to bring that gap down to the front runners. Quintana's been strong in time trials this year. So has Valverde. He's held his own in the time trials I've seen him do so far. So, yeah, I mean, I'm just going to have to get in there, have the goal of getting to the time trial in the best place possible. If I can get any seconds back, that would be great. If I don't lose any more time, that would also be great. But then, obviously, yeah, get to time trial day and give it absolutely everything I've got. For me personally, I feel that the difficult part of coming to the Vuelta after a Tour de France is that obviously all my focus goes into being ready for the tour, and you do all the altitude camps and you do everything to be I do everything to be at my best for the Tour de France. But then the Vuelta, it's just sort of, it's on the back of what I've had at the tour. We don't do any altitude camps, we don't have, I mean, especially with the Olympics in the middle, there wasn't any time to really reset, start training again, build up towards the Vuelta. That's why I feel as if certainly this first period of the Vuelta, I'm hopefully building into the race, and hopefully we'll get back to closer to my best for the last week, hopefully.
Dave Brailsford said that this winning the Vuelta was something that you really want. You know, you've won the Tour three times, you haven't won the Vuelta. What would it mean to you? Is it something that you really feel that you need, or is it just it's almost like in previous years you've looked on the Vuelta almost as the first block of training for the following year as well. Is this a title that you feel you want?
Yeah, I mean, the Vuelta, I really do want to. I'd love to win the Vuelta. It's a race, I think it's a beautiful race. It's a great part of the racing calendar. I think after the Tour de France, it is my next priority, next biggest priority. I mean, it always has been a little bit of an afterthought, but at the same time, it's the race that I first showed my potential as a GC rider, and it would mean really a lot to me if I could win it one day.
Going back quickly to the way that you've been riding the climbs, and like we saw it last year as well, is it something that you figured out for yourself, or was it after studying the numbers and the effort that you decide on this tactic of basically riding at your own pace?
I think it's something a bit of both. I mean, obviously there's the feelings you get when it's the worst feeling in the world if you start a climb too fast and you're in the red and you just, like I did a few days ago, and you just can't hold the wheel anymore. You've blown. It's in cycling. I don't think there's a worse feeling other than crashing. And I think I've learned my lesson there, that especially on climbs like yesterday that are steeper early on, that it is very easy to get lured into the red earlier on, to basically take a step back and just gauge it a little bit better earlier on. Seems to, you know, I've found it's definitely served me well.
So that was Froome speaking on the rest day. He didn't adopt a similar tactic today. I mean, a much shorter climb, but he looked very comfortable really all the way up, didn't have too many problems. The only time he maybe lost the wheels a little bit was when his teammate Leopold Koenig went to the front, but overall I think a very strong performance from Froome. And there were one or two people in the team who felt that actually the other day he was too conservative and actually had a little bit more to give.
Yeah, I think he's getting better every day. He says that he is. I suggested that to Alejandro Valverde this evening, and he sort of cut me short and said, no, Nairo's still the best rider in the race. Froome's been good throughout, but he's not getting any better. He's just at the same level. But Movistar are still very strong, aren't they? And as long as Valverde is in that third position and very close to Froome, then he's very dangerous. He's more dangerous, I think, than Koenig, particularly because of the rider he is. He's much more explosive. Having said that, Movistar have a long and inglorious history of not making the best use of Valverde and Quintana when they're riding together, don't they?
Yeah, they do. They do. I mean, it's funny, isn't it? Because we do tend to think of Quintana as somebody who gets better, certainly as the race goes on. So there's always that aspect to it as well. Also, do we not expect the Colombians, and that includes Chavez, to go better in the high mountains? I did actually ask Chavez that today. I spoke to Esteban Chavez at the finish. He put in a vicious attack on the climb and got quite a decent-sized gap. It looked like he might hold on for the win. He didn't. He was caught and he lost a bit more time. But here at the finish is Esteban Chavez. That was a big attack you put in there, Esteban.
Oh, I tried. I feel good sensation today. The stage is really hard. Sexto Bank put really uncomfortable speed for the peloton. And it's unbelievable. Four guys catch 22. Oh, it's crazy. It's good legs for Sexto today. And the final, I feel good legs after the middle of the climb. I tried, and 300 meters for the finish, for the glory.
Is this signal a sort of new way? You're going for the stage win today, you're running for GC as well, but was today just an opportunity that you saw to maybe get the win?
Yeah, all time is beautiful win, no? Did you finish 8 or 7 in the GC? It's good, but if you finish 10 and win one stage, it's better, you know?
Yeah.
The important is keeping tried, keep the limb, like tell me Matthew Heyman, and it's one more day.
Do you feel more confident in the higher climbs, you know, when you get to, you know, sort of 2,000 meters?
Yeah, for sure. And this climbs is really aggressive one. I prefer the climbs like 40 or 50 minutes, and one, another, another, another. And today's only one climb, like 20, is aggressive.
So that was the cherubic Esteban Chavez, who agrees that, you know, once we get to the higher mountains, he and, by implication, his countryman, Nairo Quintana, will perform better and get stronger. Is that you're the mountain man, Daniel?
Well,
is that something you agree with?
Well, it's been a bit of a theme throughout this season. I mean, the continued emergence of the Colombian climbers and the fact that they have tended to go better, particularly in the Giro. We saw them go very well when the race went above 2,000 metres. And the Giro d'Italia this year actually set a record for Grand Tours going over 2,000 metres. I think it was either 10 or 11 times. But this time, Richard, we're not really...
There's not many,
is there? No, there are not. Well, there are none, in fact.
I think I'm right
in saying, I'm just looking at the road book, in fact. Well, there are 2 days in the High Pyrenees, you would say. Mm. The race isn't going above 2,000 metres. So, any advantage there for the Colombians might be slightly mitigated.
Well, as Daniel scrolls through the road book looking for climbs of 2,000 metres or more, I also spoke to Dave Brailsford at the finish today. He was obviously very happy. And I think partly happy to see Froome beat Quintana after Quintana's comments about parameters. They always take these things quite personally, don't they? Because it was clearly a not very thinly veiled criticism of the way that Froome rides. And it is a further sign, I suppose, that Froome has got under Quintana's skin, which doesn't really bode well. But we'll talk about that in a moment or two. Here at the finish today was Dave Brailsford.
That's three times we're on the top of there now with Chris, obviously, in 2011, and Kirienka. And again today. Kind of regrouped yesterday, really, and the guys were really up for that today. And we just thought we'd ride in a way which would really put pressure on Quintana, you know.
Do you think also emotionally meant quite a lot to Chris? This was where he had his breakthrough. Occasionally he mentions things like that, this race as well, it means a lot to him. Yeah. Was that a factor today?
Yeah, you can never measure the psychological component, can you really? But for sure, it was a climb which Chris remembers well. And even in when we started to talk about the recon of it, you know, a lot of times people in sport will talk about, you know, athletes watching, how good it is for athletes to watch themselves perform well and what a positive impact that has. And so when doing the recon of this and you're going, OK, let's have a look at how we've raced it before, and you see yourself winning, I think that is a very, very positive thing. And he knows the climb well, and he figured out exactly how he wanted to climb it. And credit to the team today, because I thought Pete was there to start with, and then David Lopez did a great job. And then Leo Koning put in one of his best rides for us, I think. He did a fantastic job there. And we were kind of conscious of Valverde, really, in terms of, you know, obviously still sitting second overall. And, you know, it would seem to us as though, you know, we thought maybe he'd go first, and Leo was going to counter, and Leo was going to take it on and make sure the pace stayed high. And he did that to, he just played that role absolutely fantastically today. So I think he gets a big pat on the back. And then for Chris, I think once he was determined today he was going to stay on Quintana's wheel come a hell of high water, and he did. And then once he was there and the two of them were away, you know, obviously he attacked, and then I think he started to think, okay, well, I'll think about a win. And I think 9 times out of 10 I think Chris could outkick Nairo, so parameters or not, didn't make much difference.
What did you think of Quintana's call for banning parameters? Is there anything in that?
I think some people know how to use them and some people don't. I don't think it would make that much difference if you banned them, really. But then you ban speed, you ban... You know, you saw Nairo flicking through his little... Well, you know, on his garment, he was flicking away whatever he's looking at before he attacked. I think you've got to interpret comments like that in the context that they were made and at the time that they were made, and give everybody a bit of a wide berth, I think, sometimes, and just enjoy it. And I think today we saw what we all enjoy, really. It's a good old battle, isn't it? From our experience, I think when you're leading and you've got 54 seconds lead, it seems like nothing. And when you're chasing a 54 seconds lead, it seems like quite a lot. And it's funny what it does to you mentally. And you never... Again, it's only our experience, but whenever you're leading a Grand Tour, you always think the gap's never big enough. You're never quite comfortable, and it's always kind of makes you feel like a little bit, God, you know, it only takes one little thing to go wrong here, we haven't got a comfort factor, if you like. And Nairo hasn't, has he now? And I think Chris has shown that actually he can stay with him, he can beat him. He was confident he could beat him, to be fair to him. So, yeah, he doesn't want to come second again, Chris, here. So he's all in. He's all in for the win here.
Eurosport, the home of cycling.
Thank you very much to Eurosport for sponsoring the cycling podcast. We did actually resuscitate our Pedaleur de Charme award today at the Vuelta. We sort of ran a poll for you the listeners, to nominate your, or vote for your favourite Pedlar de Charme of the first week. We'll do the same on the next, or just before the next rest day, to do one for week two. There was quite a few nominations. Omar Frehley was actually our winner, our overall sort of outstanding winner of Pedlar de Charme. So I went and gave him his T-shirt. He was delighted. I also took the decision to give a T-shirt to one of our runners-up, Lewis Angle-Matte, Cofidis rider. Cofidis are actually in the hotel that we're in now, so he may make an appearance in his T-shirt at some point. He's a very delightful guy, always smiling. I noticed Larry Warbass of I Am Cycling certainly agreed with the decision to award him Pedlar de Charme. It was a bit of a misunderstanding, because I told him that, among other things, he was being given Pedlar de Charme for his gesture on the podium of picking out flowers and presenting them to the podium girls. He also just generally very nice with fans and kids and so on. You see him at the finish every day, always makes lots of time for them and smiles and is very friendly. When I mentioned the podium to him, he thought I was asking him to wear the T-shirt on the podium, and he explained, no, I'm sorry, I can't do that. He's very apologetic. Anyway, here is Lewis Angle-Matte, the Cofidis rider. We've seen you on the attack a lot. You seem to be enjoying yourself at this Vuelta.
Yeah, I'm always enjoy when I ride my bike, and when you ride your bike in the Vuelta, in your country, with this public, is fantastic. I'm happy for that, and I hope to do every day my best, and why not? I try to win one stage.
That's the goal here, is it, to win a stage?
Yeah. I prepare this Vuelta very good. That is the most important goal of the year. I was do the tour, but always with the Vuelta in the head, and now is the moment to do my best. In the training, I have a very good legs, and now I hope to do that in the race.
Any stage in particular that appeals to you, or are you just going to have a go every day?
I like particularly the Bilbao stage tomorrow, but I don't care. Every stage is a very good opportunity to do my best and to race in attacking, and I tried.
The Bilbao stage, of course, very close to your bike sponsor, Orbea. Is that one reason?
Yeah, for sure. País Basque is the best area in the world for the cycling, with the incredible public, with the very good roads, and always when I have the opportunity to ride in País Basque, it's something special.
I've seen you at the finish, and you always stop and speak to fans, give them bottles, stop for photographs. You do seem to enjoy yourself. You seem to have a smile on your face most of the time.
For sure, that is one of the most beautiful things of the cycling. Spoke with the people, with the supporter. That is incredible, and I always thank you for all the people to support the cycling.
Well, you're very popular with our little listeners of the cycling podcast, who voted in large numbers for you to be our Pedlar de Charme.
Ah, yeah. It's an honor to take this T-shirt, and I'm sure I put in Marbella, in my home.
And don't wear it on the podium.
Yeah.
There's a bit of a misunderstanding there. You thought we were asking you to wear it on the podium, but you don't have to do that.
Yeah.
So it was Lewis Angle-Matte, the very charming Lewis Angle-Matte of Cofidis, Pedlar de Charme, who clearly just enjoys riding his bike, as he told us. He seems to always be having fun. Speaking of fun, I did a Facebook Live event on Monday on the Eurosport Facebook page. You can still watch that. Go back and watch that if you go to the British Eurosport Facebook page. There's also a link to it from our own Facebook page, the Cycling Podcast, with Ian Boswell of Team Sky. And it was very kind of Ian to give up the time to do that. We took lots of questions from people, and it was good. I sat there on the sofa in the hotel with him, with two Pedlar de Charme T-shirts beside me the whole time, fully intending to give him one at the end as a thank you for doing the event. And I forgot. And he saw them there, and must have thought, very rude.
His eyes must have lit up, mustn't they?
So I went to see him this morning and said I'd forgotten to give him one of the T-shirts. So I made amends for that. And here is me handing over the Pedlar de Charme T-shirt to Ian Boswell this morning. Ian, I meant to give you this Pedlar de Charme T-shirt as a thank you for doing the Facebook Live.
Yeah, well, as a friend and a member of the podcast, I'm a big fan of the Pedlar de Charme, and I'm honored to have a T-shirt.
A huge moment for you.
Yeah, it really is. You know, I haven't really won too many prizes in my career. We got a watch after the Team Tom Trail, but I would say this is up there with the Tissot watch we got.
So that was Ian Boswell receiving his Pedaleur de Charme t-shirt in Vuelta colours. We've got white and black models with red and yellow lettering, so they're very nice. And as I said, we'll present more Pedaleur de Charme t-shirts next week. Daniel, you want to say something about where we're staying tonight, and this might lead on to a more general discussion about Spanish cycling, because we were talking about the crowds today in particular, but where are we?
Well, we're in Torrelavega, which is the hometown of Oscar Freire, three-time world champion, three-time Milan San Remo winner.
Famous yogurt fan.
Generally one of the most popular riders of the last 15 years. A pretty charming character. I remember coming to his house once in Torrelavega, and he was very proud. He was very keen to show me his new lawnmower, which was a wireless lawnmower, which you just could plonk down on the lawn and it would then take its own measurements off the front lawn and it would cut the whole thing. Well, this is what it was supposed to do. And Oscar Freire kind of stood back and said, watch this. He gave me a nudge in the elbow, in the ribs, and said, watch this. You'll love this. This is really going to impress you. 5 seconds after starting its journey, this lawnmower headed off the edge of the lawn and fell off what was practically a cliff. It was a bit like my car the other day.
I didn't think you were going to reveal that.
A curb. Minor damage sustained to the car.
Minor damage to the car that you had to replace. Yeah.
Anyway, don't know where that came from.
Yeah, interesting stuff.
That's
Daniel.
What I was going to say, Richard. Yeah. Oscar Freire was well known for his artisanal approach. He didn't use a heart rate monitor and certainly did not use a power meter. And of course, power meters have been a hot topic of debate.
Yeah, well, let's talk about power meters in a moment or two. We had a heated debate last night about Alejandro Valverde, who we're just saying what a remarkable career he's had of incredible consistency. But actually, if you look at his palmarès, it doesn't stack up. Probably doesn't stack up alongside Oscar Freire's, who certainly was much less consistent, very erratic. He would disappear for months on end. But if you look at the actual races that he won and the, you know, the world titles and Milan San Remo's, Valverde's been incredibly consistent, but actually he will probably retire. He's probably got another couple of years left in him, but no world title. Couple of monuments, Liège-Bastogne-Liège, but he won Liège-Bastogne-Liège more than once. He has, yeah. So, you know, it's a funny one, that. A remarkably consistent rider, but as you said, Daniel, last night, somebody who might in 10, 15, 20 years be almost forgotten because he's not perhaps in the pantheon of the greats. We were talking as well about the climb today, the fantastic crowds. Once again, very well behaved, but also very well policed. They left a good bit of road for the riders to go through, and I noticed the police were being maybe slightly heavy-handed with spectators who encroached into the riders' of racing line, as it were. But I have to say that, you know, the vast majority of fans have been very well behaved, and there have been a lot of them. I was in a little bar near the finish watching the finish, and then we went to the team buses afterwards, and the bar was packed as well with people watching the Vuelta. There seems to be great interest in it.
Yeah, there is, and again, the Vuelta has really reinvented itself to good effect. I mean, visiting the coastal regions in the last week of August has certainly born fruit. The Vuelta used to take place a little bit later, of course. It used to start in September, didn't it?
You started April. First,
well, yeah. But after that, up until a couple of years ago, it started in the first week of September. And I would suggest, particularly when they do visit the coastal regions, they get a lot of people who are on holiday, and that seems to be the case today, and stop off to watch the Vuelta. And also, you know, you mentioned Valverde there, and of course the spectre of Operación Puerto will always loom large over his career, and it did loom large, and certainly the issue of doping loomed large over Spanish cycling for a long time. But the last 3 or 4 years, there hasn't been an awful lot as far as doping news in Spain in Spanish cycling is concerned, and that has also probably been beneficial in terms of restoring the race's image, I would suggest.
Yeah, much to be positive about, no pun intended there. Any other riders catch your eye today? We're going to talk about the power meter debate in inverted commas in a moment, but I wanted to mention Pierre Latour, 22 years old, AG2R rider, who rode very well today. He was right up there, ninth on the stage. Excellent ride by him. He's a great French prospect. We're hoping to get Francois Thomazeau back on the podcast tomorrow, so maybe he can tell us a little bit more about him. But all the usual suspects up there. Simon Yates, a very good ride by him, sixth on the stage, a little bit ahead of Chavez. I was wondering whether Chavez was thinking more about stage wins now than overall, and he seemed to suggest that he was. He certainly said he'd be happier with 10th overall in a stage win than 8th overall in no stage win. not ruling out, he knows as well as anybody from the Giro this year that things can change quite dramatically.
It wasn't a very brotherly attack by Nairo Quintana, was it? He effectively ended his compatriot Esteban Chavez's hopes of a stage win, didn't he? I mean, it was a fair distance from the finish. I would suggest that Chavez's move was perhaps doomed anyway, but still, it was Quintana that chased him down. Chavez laughed that off when I put it to him at the...
is there any other reaction from Chavez?
No, not really.
To smile and laugh. So Parameters, Daniel, what do you think of this? I said earlier that it's yet another indication that Froome is under Quintana's skin. It's a bit churlish of him, is it not, to call for a ban on Parameters the day after Froome has appeared to ride according to what Parameters telling him, whether that's true or not. But he certainly was pacing his effort according to his own capabilities rather than following Quintana and Contador when they attack.
Yeah, it's a nonsense, really. I mean, is Quintana suggesting that they give certain riders an advantage? Well, if he's so determined to ride on feel, that's obviously because he thinks that that is the best option for him, and that gives him an advantage to not be tied to things like power meters and data and, you know, rigorous training plans or whatever it is that he doesn't use. So I really can't see any reasonable logic in it whatsoever. And then, you know, as Froome said at the finish, are we also going to go back to single speed bicycles? Because it would be, of course, a retrograde step, and particularly a problem when, you know, amateurs, inferior riders have access to certain tools, and if professionals didn't, then you know, it's the same argument that's been made for many years about the weight limit with bikes. You know, why should amateurs be able to have a bike that weighs less than 6.8 kilograms and professionals not? Which is also a valid point. They also are part of the sport,
you
know, now.
Ian Boswell spoke a bit about this in our Facebook Live event, and Froome's spoken about it. When Froome says, "I don't ride according to what my parameter is telling me," a lot of people poo-poo that, but I believe it. I mean, it is a race, and I think that no matter how well trained you are and how well you know your body, sometimes in a race situation, the effect of the crowd, the situation in the race, the fact that, you know, if you're attacking somebody or you're with somebody or you've been dropped, that all affects the effort that you're able to make. I don't believe that you can program yourself like a computer to ride according to what your parameter is telling you. I just don't think humans work like that.
No, and I can remember not so much a clamour, but there were certainly murmurings in the 1990s when heart rate monitors became in vogue. There were some old school director sportives, maybe riders as well, saying similar things to what Quintana has said over the last 24 hours, that they were making racing more boring, the riders were paying too much attention to them. And I think, you know, most amateurs have probably had the experience in the last 10 years of wanting to go riding with a friend or their usual training partner and it becoming quite irritating because their training partner is determinedly following a particular training plan that means they have to go at a certain number of watts, and it just kind of ruined the vibe. It is a vibe killer in a way, and it probably, to a certain extent, Quintana feels that it is in professional cycling.
Chatting to Dave Brailsford after we turned the tape off at the finish, it was interesting because on the climb the other day, Covadonga, the Lagos de Covadonga, a lot of very fast times were set up there. You know, if you look at the leaderboard of times, a lot of new entries in there, you know, some very fast times. The issue there is that the riders rode it, a lot of them, in a different way to how they often ride it, in that it was almost like a time trial. I mean, in a race situation, there are lulls. You do ride according to others' pace. It goes up and down. That's why I find, you know, timing riders from the bottom to the top of a climb in a road race to be a very blunt instrument when it comes to drawing any kind of conclusions or extrapolating anything at all from the time, unless you had guys from the bottom, saying to them at the bottom, right, your job is to get to the top as quickly as possible. It doesn't really work because in a race, as I said, there are lulls. I think the other day it was slightly different in that because the race split up, everybody kind of did go as fast as they could all the way up. But even then, you know, there were moments where Quintana and Contador were going hard and then easing off. You know, Contador's accelerations were forcing them into the red a little bit. They were easing off. Froome was the guy that rode the most measured ride, and possibly had a little bit more to give than he gave, as he explained earlier in the interview.
Anyway, Richard, it's not going to happen, is it? Power meters will never be banned. There's too much money in that business now. It's become a very, very lucrative business and very big players involved. Long gone are the days when Uli Scherber and his SRM system were the only options. As I say, big players in that market now. There is no way the UCI is going to step in.
No. Peña Cabarga is where Chris Froome had his first ever professional victory. And 5 years on, he's done that again. People still expressing huge surprise, you know, whenever Froome performs as he does. I think we've talked about this a lot, but it owes something to how Froome looks on a bike, because you don't get the same reaction to Quintana winning as he did the other day. In fact, a lot of the talk around the stage the other day was about Froome's performance rather than Quintana's, even though Quintana won. It's odd, isn't it? At what point are we going to not be surprised by Froome riding as well as he clearly can and winning? We look at it now in the overall context. I mean, Froome, people still talk about his transformation in 2011. He'd been at Team Sky at that time 18 months, you know, 2010 till August 2011, around 18 months. It's funny. I mean, 5 years now, he's been at the level that he's at the moment.
I think his level over the last 5 years has been very, very consistent, extremely consistent throughout each one of those five seasons, you know, from February to, well, whenever he's concluded his season. Obviously, the problem that a lot of skeptics have is the sudden, you know, it's a sudden arrival, what seems to be a sudden arrival at that level, having not really shown that much of that kind of pedigree prior to the 2011 Vuelta. But, you know, that's a very long, thorny topic, isn't it? That we've gone into several times before and we'll go into again.
Whoever you are, wherever you ride, whatever the reason, Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories and vibrant clubhouses and communities all over the world. See rafa.cc for more information.
Look, Daniel, there's Luis Leon Sanchez.
Very, very timely.
Walking past.
You've only walked past 15 minutes ago.
Astana. Astana is staying in this hotel as well. Cofidis and Astana. Thank you very much to Rafa for sponsoring the cycling podcast, as they have been doing since the start of Tour de France. Very grateful to them for their sponsorship. And they will continue sponsoring us after the Vuelta. And we've got lots of exciting plans with them, haven't we, Daniel? Lots.
Yeah, lots of exciting plans with them.
Lots of exciting plans. The other thing I want to say is, I mentioned the other day on the podcast that I'd spotted Simon Clark at the finish with his hand sort of tucked in to his jersey, looking in a lot of pain. It turned out he'd done himself real damage. He crashed with about 15 kilometres to go of the stage and broken his shoulder and done other damage as well. I mean, it sounded very, very nasty indeed. I spoke to the Cannondale doctor, Rick Morgan, at the start today just to find out what Simon Clark had been through in order to finish the stage and the extent of his injuries. Here is Rick Morgan.
He had a dislocated shoulder, but he was able to finish, but is not able to start today, despite that.
Well, it's amazing that he was able to finish. Am I right in thinking that he rode quite a lot of it with his hand tucked into his shirt?
Yeah, I wasn't there. I just came in the rest day, but my understanding is he finished about 14 or 15K like that by himself, yeah.
So when did the crash happen?
I guess about that 15K to go or something, as far as I know.
So. And did you speak to him? I mean, was he able to tell you how he managed to finish the stage with that injury?
Well, Simon's a bit tough. he's injured the shoulder before, and he's had other injuries as well. And so, yeah, he's a tough character. So he's able to finish because he knew that there was a chance that maybe he could keep going.
Do you think he knew the severity of it?
Yeah, he said when he hit the ground, he knew that it was a bad injury, not something small.
And there was no chance, obviously, that he could carry on?
Not at this point, no. Not safe for him to be able to ride, and he's going to go on further assessment, I guess you'd say.
Have you ever seen a rider finish a stage with such a bad one?
No, I have not. A lot of other sports, as people know, you know, people are done, and these guys just keep going until they decide.
Was he disappointed yesterday to learn the full extent of it and to realize that his Vuelta was over?
Yeah, he's been riding really well. He's just, you know, real strong, real fit, and our road captain as well, so he was very disappointed.
And what's next for him?
You know, I don't know. We'll find out more. He's heading for some further evaluation in Bilbao, I believe, or in Barcelona. Actually, I don't know. So we'll know more later.
So Simon Clark, a real warrior performance to finish the stage with such nasty injuries. He did ride quite a lot of the the last 15 kilometers with his hand tucked into his jersey, obviously knowing there was a rest day the next day and he would have a chance to really assess the extent of the damage. I spoke to Gary Beckett, the Cannondale Drapac soigneur, as well today. He said that Simon Clark was desperate to carry on riding and was wondering if there was a way that he could carry on. But sadly not, and he's out of the Vuelta.
He's had a fairly unfortunate first season with Cannondale, hasn't he? Ridden very well at times, but not really had that much reward.
No, I mean, that kind of sums up the team, doesn't it? They had Pierre Roland in the break again today, and they are hunting for Sagemann.
There was a very nasty accident, actually, on the way down the climb today on Peña Cabarga. This is one problem with the Vuelta's litany of summit finishes, that very often the riders have to ride down. And as we said earlier, the crowds are very, very good here at the Vuelta. Awful lot of people are on bikes. But I think what happened today was that an amateur rider coming back up the climb after the finish had been struck, and the Cannondale car was pulled over, and their doctor was attending to someone who'd been quite badly hurt at the side of the road, and his bike had, well, it flown into a ravine, and it was about 10 metres below where he was sort of lying.
Gary Beckett also told me, Daniel, that Paddy Bevan, the Cannondale Drapac rider, is out of the race. He had a nasty crash early in the race, and I don't know if he broke his thumb, but he certainly bent his thumb back, and it had a really nasty injury. He was determined to finish this race, but he is out. I spoke to Andrew Talansky, the Cannondale Drapac rider, the only one of their riders who's not really trying to get in breaks, because he's riding for GC pretty unspectacularly. He's up to 11th overall. He was very confident that he would come good in the third week. He says traditionally he gets better in the third week. And yeah, well, I'll not play my interview with him because it was pretty brief. And
That's not the word you used earlier. That's not the adjective you used.
You know, I let's just say that he probably isn't a winner of Pedal de Charme at any point. Maybe. I mean, that could be wrong. Maybe he'll be in the list of nominees next week. Who knows? But Pedal de Charme is good. And it was interesting to get Larry Warbass's feedback on Lewis Angulmati. It's interesting to hear who's popular within the bunch, isn't it? Who the other riders like. That tells you a lot, usually, about that person. Maybe we should introduce something for the opposite, the sort of anti-Pedaleur de Charme. What do you think?
Yeah.
And then it can be your job, because it's my job to give Pedaleur de Charme t-shirts, and that's always very pleasant. But it could be your job to...
Yeah, I'm very busy, as you know, Richard, but it's a tough task to take the Pedaleur de Charme, certainly the overall title, off Esteban Chavez when he's riding, isn't it?
It is. I mean, he was our overall Pedaleur de Charme at the Giro, of course, and he seemed to appreciate that, but then he smiled, which was nice. He did smile a lot. Shall we wrap things up there, Daniel?
Let's do it.
Okay, let's go and have dinner. Thank you very much, and we'll speak again tomorrow night.
Thank you, Richard.